This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
It's very difficult to keep the line between the past and the present.
You believe that someone out of the past can enter and take possession of a living being?
We may be through with the past, but the past is not through with us.
Welcome to the Next Picture Show, a Movie of the Week podcast devoted to a classic film and how it's shaped our thoughts on a recent release. I'm Tasha Robinson, here with
Genevieve Kosky
and Keith Phipps.
Scott Tobias is currently on vacation, but he will be back. Here on the Next Picture Show, we believe that no film exists in a vacuum and that all culture is more interesting in context. So every other week, we get together to talk over a classic film and consider how it relates to a current movie. This week, we have two unconventional children's movies made by unconventional creators working at the top of their fields and actively trying to push the envelope of their respective crafts. Both films are epic fantasies about kids who lose parent figures, make strange new animal friends, recover magical items, and face terrifying evil. In other words, they're both about characters on classic heroes' journeys. Genevieve, if you could fold up those girl wings for just a sec, I would like you to tell our listeners what we're talking about this week.
Well, sure. We're all fans of Leica, the Portland, Oregon studio that produced the stop-motion pictures Coraline, Paranorman, and The Box Trolls. So we were particularly excited when we got the first teasers for Leica's new project, Kubo and the Two Strings. It's set in a mythical version of ancient Japan, where music is literally magical. There's a dragon in the moon, and origami creatures can walk and fight, if they're made by the right person. We had a lot of different options for pairings, and we spent such a long time debating different options that we eventually kicked it back to our fans on social media. We'll get to some of the other suggestions in this week's feedback session, but we finally decided on pairing Kubo and the Two Strings with Jim Henson's 1982 fantasy, The Dark Crystal. The two films don't look much alike, and Kubo is a stop-motion animated film, while Dark Crystal was shot in real time, with puppets and elaborate costumes. But both films share a behind-the-scenes aesthetic, and both were made by small studios devoted to expanding what was possible in their medium. Leica CEO and director Travis Knight and Dark Crystal director Jim Henson actually have a lot in common.
And both of these films share some central ideas about good versus evil, about how much scary stuff kids can handle, and about how big of an epic adventure you can fit on a tabletop. So here we go, into some very small spaces that open up into some very big worlds.
Another world. Another time. In the age of wonder. 1,000 years ago, this land was green and good, until the crystal cracked. For a single piece was lost, a shard of the crystal. Then strife began, and two new races appeared. The cruel Skeksis, the gentle mystics. Here in the castle of the crystal, the Skeksis took control.
On the commentary track on the 25th anniversary edition of Dark Crystal, conceptual designer Brian Froud sounds kind of gleeful when he points out that the protagonist on screen isn't a puppet in many shots, he's a little person in a costume and mask. People often say Dark Crystal is wonderful because it's pure puppetry, Froud says on the commentary, and I say, the hell it is. That wasn't the point. What we did was use any trick we could use to make people believe in things. That quote particularly struck me because it's so much like something Kubo director Travis Knight told me when I went to visit Leica Studios earlier this year for a behind-the-scenes tour. Part of that tour involved watching before and after special effects sequences where an entire crowd of characters were computer-generated, or the stormy ocean around a struggling ship was entirely digital. Given Leica's reputation for doing everything it can with practical camera effects, I asked Travis if the company is using more CGI these days. And he said, "We're not purists about stop motion. We love it, but within these walls you have people that are giant, throbbing, NASA-sized brains that are inventing technologies. And then you have Luddites, people who are essentially still working with their hands, like artists and craftspeople were a century ago. I love that convergence of different types of methodologies and people. I think it creates a ground for innovation. Both of these quotes are striking to me because Jim Henson and Travis Knight have gotten such reputations as throwbacks and diehards, going to the mat for one particular storytelling method that they do better than anyone else. And to some degree, that's a myth that we tell ourselves because it makes for a better story. That seems kind of appropriate, since both of these creators are so heavily invested in myth-making and in tapping into something primal about fairy tales and magical stories. But just like Travis Knight, Henson was an innovator first and foremost. And by all reports, The Dark Crystal came more out of his desire to create new, bigger, more visually ambitious effects than out of a desire to tell one specific story. The Dark Crystal has a couple of clear genesis points. One came in 1977, when Henson signed a deal with Froud to start designing costumes and creatures and sets for The Dark Crystal, which he wouldn't start shooting for nearly another 4 years. The other came in 1978, when Henson and his daughter Cheryl were snowed in and sat down to create the world of The Dark Crystal. Note that Henson hadn't written a script at either one of those points. The look of the film came before the screenplay, and from everything I've read, it sounds like the creatures came before the story. The Dark Crystal is a swords and sorcery fantasy about a world where an evil bird-like race called Skeksis ruled the world from a dark castle dominated by a dark crystal that was broken 1,000 years ago. According to a prophecy, a member of a race of gentle elf-like beings called Gelflings will heal the broken crystal and change the world. So the Skeksis have all but wiped out the Gelflings to preserve their power. Two of them are still alive, a boy named Jen, raised in a secret valley by a quiet four-armed race of people called Mystics, and Kira, a girl raised by simple dumpling-like people. I mean, come on, they're simple dumpling-like people, guys. I've got a whole story about that, but we'll get to it. Jen and Kira meet accidentally, and they're more or less forced by circumstance to try to fix the Dark Crystal for their own survival. It's a little hard for people who grew up on this film to understand this decades later, but when The Dark Crystal came out in 1982, that plot was the big sticking point for cultural critics. The film made modest money at the box office, but even though film writers raved about the visuals, they expressed disappointment with the story. Vincent Canby, writing for the New York Times, called it, quote, watered down J.R.R. Tolkien, unquote, and said it had, quote, no narrative drive whatsoever. It's without charm as well as interest, unquote. And even today, I'm not sure I'd recommend it as a film to adults who never saw it in childhood. You can see the craft on screen, but it still may be a movie you only really find magical if you first encountered it as a kid. And that's something I've read critics saying about Kubo and the Two Strings as well, that it's impeccably crafted, but that it's missing a certain narrative drive or intensity that would let its themes hit home as hard as Travis Knight and his co-creators at Laika would like. So we're going to look at what these two films do with their fantasy settings and how they do it, but we're also going to think a little bit about the craft that went into both films and ask whether it's possible it got in the way of the story. We'll be right back with that after this.
Now there's the great shaft of the castle. Position the reflector. The reflector will capture the beams of the dark crystal floating high above. Look into the reflector, Podling. Feel the power of the dark crystal. Yes, and now the beam will rid you of your fears, your thoughts, your vital essence.
So guys, what do you think about The Dark Crystal as a film?
That's tough for me to answer because I am one of those people that saw this as a kid in the theater and really liked it. But I don't think I'd seen it, gosh, since it's maybe once on home video after that. So it wasn't particularly fresh in my mind. But I think the craft is so strong here that whatever shortcomings it has as a piece of storytelling, it didn't really bother me that much. I was very impressed to watch the film again. It is definitely a one-of-a-kind film from a year that kind of produced a lot of other films like Blade Runner and such that were a little ahead of their time. Although this is, I don't think, calling this ahead of its time might be even a little, I think it's ahead of the curve fantasy-wise. I think it's bringing pretty straightforward fantasy storytelling to the screen in a way, like take a while for Lord of the Rings and such and to catch up with it in terms of films. But just visually, it's like nothing else.
Yeah, you kind of hit on all my big points there in the keynote, Tasha. So, you know, I'm just going to go. The story is kind of...
including the dumpling people? You were going to talk about
Yeah,
the
actually,
people?
I brought one note to this entire recording. It just says dumpling people and big Crayola crayons. No, I saw this film, I think, when I was too young to process it. Like, for all intents and purposes, I had not seen this film because my memory of it was so vague. So I was looking forward to, like, kind of filling in the holes of my memory that was really just kind of images, you know, of the Skeksis and the Mystics and just those amazing puppet creations. And watching it again, now I was like, oh, this just didn't make sense to begin with. That's why I didn't remember it.
Well, on the one hand, it's a really elaborate fantasy world, but on the other hand, it is a very simple story.
Exactly.
It's like Gelfling goes from point A to point B.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It's and I think watching it in tandem with Kubo, it kind of highlights how they both kind of half-ass the hero's journey narrative and that they follow the hero's journey narrative but kind of skip past a lot of the big emotional beats that are required, I think, to make that narrative work. Like, Jen and I think Kubo are not particularly great protagonists because you don't really understand what makes them tick or what drives them. I think that's kind of a big storytelling flaw the two films share to different degrees. But, you know, as a piece of craft, and it's just something to watch and marvel at and say, how did they do that? How does that work? It's perfectly engaging from that standpoint. And to an extent, I would say the same of Kubo. So watching it is still like a totally worthwhile venture, but it's probably not one you should go into expecting to get your mind blown from a storytelling perspective.
Keith, I mean, we'll get to my feelings on it in a second, but Keith, just before we recorded, you were saying that you probably wouldn't show this to your 5-year-old because you think it's too dark and scary for her. And that kind of brings up an interesting thing. If you have to engage with this movie when you're young in order to still find it, you know, magical and a relatable fantasy story instead of a really interesting piece of craft, 5 is too young. Like, when is old enough? When would you actually show it to your kids?
Oh, I mean, I saw it when I was 9 or 10, which is like maybe around the same time I started reading Tolkien and C.S. Lewis. So this was, I was kind of primed for this, or I was at the right age for this. So perhaps that, I don't know. I think for a younger child, as simple as the story is in many ways, it's going to be just a lot of grim imagery and, you know, little creatures having their essences sucked out of them. At one
point, very Clockwork Orange.
I thought the dog was going to die. Like, I'd forgotten that the dog gets kind of rescued at the last minute, possibly in post-production after, you know, a scene added in post-production. I don't know.
I don't think so. There's too much, like, onset with that happening, I think, for it to have been a last-minute decision. Also, it's Jim Henson.
He's not going to kill the dog. That's true. Or whatever we're calling this creature. That's clearly...
It was clearly a cat, you guys.
I wondered if we were going to get into the dog-cat thing after Pete's Dragon last week. Its name is Fizzgig.
It barks. It's a dog.
It barks and it follows Kira devotedly every day. She goes,
yeah.
It's a dog.
Yeah. A cat would have said peace out long before.
Yeah. Just wandered off to chase one of the million fuzzy little things scurrying around the landscape.
Right.
You know, I saw this film when I was kind of at the height of my Jim Henson obsession, when I basically just wanted to grow up to be a puppeteer. And like, I found it so magical when I was a kid. I got the novel and I read the novel. I got the film once it was available and watched it enough times that watching it this time, I was surprised at how much of the dialogue I could have just recited from memory. I had the soundtrack, which I loved and listened to all the time. Recently, as an adult, Arkea, I think, was the graphic novel company, came out with a series of graphic novels that were like the backstory of The Dark Crystal, that are about like the world before everything happened. And it's really amazing how uninteresting it is to try to tell the story before the story in this case.
So that voice, that incredibly repetitive voiceover at the beginning of The Dark Crystal, is just repeated even more in that backstory.
You know, I didn't even think about hearing it in that voice, but now I'm going to have to go back and reread those books and keep that in mind. I like that repetitive voiceover. It's like poetry. It's mm-hmm. deliberately repetitive.
I guess the one question I would have that any sort of like, expanding universe stuff could answer is like, how long ago was the Gelfling purge? Because it seems like it maybe took place a long time ago, and yet here's Jim and Kira hanging around.
Yeah, that whole thing is weird. I mean, I kind of assume that Gelflings were a reasonably populous race and, you know, that there was a huge purge and then the survivors kind of lingered on. Because it's pretty clear that, well, we also don't know how long Gelflings live. I mean, they're clearly based on elves. They, like, Jen could be 250 years old and, like, still an adolescent.
We might be getting to the minutiae of this particular film.
We also might be thinking more about it than they did.
Yeah, that's true.
Because that's the thing that, like, the more you dig into the story behind the story, the more you find out that Jim Henson was really deeply invested in how different kinds of puppets moved. Mm-hmm. How he was, like, one of his lifelong obsessions was, how can you create a puppet that doesn't look like it's being puppeted, that doesn't look like it's on strings or has a wind-up effect or has a person inside it? And you see all of these little things, the little rolling creatures and flapping creatures and things that pop up and down, the giant bug-like Garthim, like, scuttling around on all of their tentacles.
Those things.
I'm sorry, what's wrong with them? Just because they're giant insect-like things, like, as big as a person?
Don't want to think about it.
You can see all of his obsessions in this film, but then you kind of you end up with some really large and basic story questions mm-hmm. that there's no way to answer.
Let's talk about them, I guess.
Well, what else came up for you? Like, what else do you see as a story flaw?
You know, not so much flawed, but in some ways it just seemed like the mystical guiding force behind this is a little, it's at once vague and kind of simple at the same time. You know, there's evil, but it's forceful and it can actually get things done. And there's this mystic good, but they're also very, you know, slow and kind of weak willed. I don't know what comes of merging the light and darkness with this weird cosmology created, because the mystics seem by far preferable to the Skeksis. I guess they balance each other out. That's kind of the whole point. Yin and yang, the cosmos is aligned once again, or whatever happens in this movie. But, I don't know if I necessarily want it spelled out anymore, but it's not all that satisfying the way it plays out.
Yeah, I think just kind of the weird, almost semi-destructive simplicity of the story can kind of be boiled down to the word shard, and how often they talk about this crystal shard, and what do you do with the shard, and what could you possibly do with this piece of a giant broken crystal? What could the prophecy be talking about? It's like, obviously you put the shard into the crystal, guys. I mean, this is not that difficult. And just like the hammering of this same point that was like a very kind of belabored, simple plot point.
Put tab A into slot B.
Yeah, exactly.
But I almost feel like dwelling on this stuff is kind of beside the point with this movie, because it is such
I was very distracted by the word shard. In this viewing. Like, I'm like, if they say shard one more time, I'm turning this off.
All right. Well, the point I'm trying to make, though, is like, I felt like I was watching, like, you know, the covers of a bunch of 70s fantasy novels mm-hmm, come to mm-hmm. life. And to me, that was something I enjoyed watching. I mean, just even if the sort of the cosmos wasn't well developed or the characters all that compelling, I did find watching these sort of like symbolic creatures walking through this landscape quite lovely and quite the visual accomplishment.
You talked about how Kubo and Jen both are kind of not humongously interesting protagonists. I like a lot of the tone of Jen. I mean, I think the kind of the tone of Jen is he's a very Henson creation. He's very quiet. He's very peaceful. Like, the thing that makes him distinctive is playing little musical notes. But I mean, he's not really all that much of a hero, and yet he does these heroic things. That said, I'm wondering if part of the difficulty I've always had engaging with him is that his face is so rigid. Mm-hmm. I mean, was that a distraction for you guys? Is that just me?
Not really, because it seemed like kind of like a cartoon face in some ways, and if it were more expressive, it might be harder to identify with.
It was something I was willing to just kind of chalk up to the form of the film, but, you know, yeah, I'll say that it is a little bit of a problem in terms of just creating the emotional drive for Jen, specifically the part where he's watching his master die, and like that is supposed to be the inciting incident of this hero's journey, and there needs to be some emotional drive behind it other than he was told to do it. And I think kind of logically you connect the dots that his grief over his master's death is what's driving him, but you don't necessarily see that grief play out in that scene, and that is maybe at least partially due to the rigidity of Jen's face. Because I recall there being several shots in that scene that just kind of long, lingering shots of Jen's face. And it seemed like that he wasn't really doing much. Like, why are we watching him? And it's like, oh, he's emoting, but you can't actually see him emoting that well.
There's one of the things on that Brian Froud commentary is he says almost bitterly, puppets don't really do much. And he's kind of talking about how, you know, you have to get in there and be responsible for animating. You have to get in there and be responsible for everything they bring across because they're not really capable of communicating. Mm-hmm. I mean, we think of Muppets as so expressive.
Well, felt moves in a way that whatever material they're using for the faces here doesn't.
Yeah, Jen is perhaps a little too humanoid for his own good. I mean, obviously he's a gelfling slash elf, but maybe if he was a little more beast-like instead of human-like, it may have been easier to kind of exaggerate those features the way that the Muppets are.
We should put a pin on this for part two of this discussion too, because Kubo is super expressive. And actually find Kubo a much more satisfying protagonist, but we can get into that in part two.
Yeah, we'll definitely get into that. Speaking of that scene where Jen watches his master die and disappear, isn't it a little weird? You know, we got this film that Frank Oz is so heavily involved in as a puppeteer and a voiceover. You see where I'm going with this?
I see where you're going with
1982,
this.
1983, we watch this exact same scene with Mark Hamill and Yoda, also voiced and operated by Frank Oz, sits there and watches his master die and then disappear. And it's like they're too close together and both of them had too long of a lead time for one to have consciously copied the other. But that's just a really weird coincidence.
It's how wise old wizards die.
Well,
just the way it works.
I also got some Star Wars Universe flashes in the Podlings celebration, which was very Ewok-esque as well.
Wow, good point. Right down to the fact that they have like their own little yubby song.
Yeah, yeah. Again, we're dealing within like well-trod fantasy tropes. So, you know, I don't know that there's a direct line to be drawn there, but it's an interesting echo.
Yeah, it's just it's a weird coincidence. So I called them dumpling people. They actually, it's just a random piece of trivia I picked up from Brian Froud. He designed them as potatoes.
I like, can see that.
Literally, they had like 4 or 5 or 6 eyes apiece and looked way more like potatoes. And then they tried it in puppet form and they decided it just didn't work. You couldn't tell where they were looking.
Yeah.
And so they didn't have personality. So they had to dial back the potato-tude. So I'm curious, we have been circling around and around the idea of dated on this podcast for a while now. There are handmade things in this movie that I think really still hold up. And then there are special effects that really don't, you know, pre-digital special effects like matte effects that are really visually obvious. And I'm curious how much that got in the way for you guys.
Well, I mean, I'm the last person to admit something as dated, but what in particular stood out for you as not working as well?
I'm thinking of just some of the matte shots where it's very obvious that one set of characters is matted in over the other. They've got like the big glowing outline that was such a problem in films of the time. There are a couple of different places where it's very obvious that there's a miniature set and characters shot at a different scale and matted in, or two different sets of characters shot at different times and matted together.
I wasn't really that taken out by it though, because we're in this weird puppety world to begin with. So whatever distortions of reality are taking place there, it doesn't really take me out. I will say this. There's a scene I remember very clearly from when I saw it years and years ago. And that is when the Gelflings sleep off and the female Gelfling, Kira, spouts wings and says, you have wings? Like, I don't have wings. You don't, of course not. I'm a girl. A couple of things about that. I remember that being like this really sweeping, they like fly all around and everything. And they really don't. It really is just like a puppet being lowered down with wings. Maybe in my mind, I kind of compensated for some of the limitations of the effects and imagined as it would be done now. It's kind of charming in its own way, though, the smallness of that moment, I thought.
I'll take your bait, Tasha. I think a lot of the special effects don't look particularly great, less so because they are the D word, and just because when placed next to some of the physical effects that are happening, they look, and I know they're not lazy, but they look lazy by comparison. I'm thinking specifically of the big moment at the end where the Skeksis and the Mystics merge into their Urskeks. Is that what they're called?
Which look, I know this is an aside, but for as much as the Skeksis and the Mystics look alike, their merge form looked nothing like either of them.
Well, yeah.
They're also not physical bodies anymore.
Yeah, right. Yeah. But that's kind of the point I'm making, is that they just kind of merge from these incredible, big, lumbering puppets with physicality into these little like wispy projection type things. And that may have been intentional, but it just feels kind of like some of the air is being let out. And then I think of that in comparison to a moment earlier in the film when the Skeksis Emperor dies and he literally just dissolves from the inside and crumbles. And it's this incredible effect that I have no idea how they did. And I'm sure there's video out there somewhere of how they did it, but I kind of don't want to know because it seems so magical. And the same effect could be done on a computer in 5 minutes today, but it's so much more kind of wondrous watching that actual physical matter crumble in that way. So that scene at the end where it's just these special effect wispy Ursex compared to something so physical as that, it just felt less spectacular in the literal sense of the word.
Yeah, there is a lot of spectacle for spectacle's sake here. And I'm wondering, I mean, this would be a very different movie if it was paced like a movie today. Mm-hmm. Do you think that the fact that so much of the film is devoted to these kind of like long, there's the shot at the beginning with Jen naked by the river playing his pipes. There's Jen and Kira's long trip down the river where you're kind of supposed to be admiring the scenery and like the creatures. There's so much just landscape in this mm-hmm. film. And again, this is all about craft. This is all about Jim Henson wanting to create an environment and wanting to create all these little puppet creatures. Do you want less of that? If it would be a very different film with right. a very different pacing.
Yeah, no, I like the pace of this film in that way. I liked all the shots of these puppets walking against a real landscape, or it's kind of unclear to me. There's a couple of shots. Were they actually shooting outside?
No, it's a constructed landscape. The river, I believe, is real, but I believe that the sort of the foreground are constructed pieces.
Those are some of my favorite shots sure. in the film. Probably I'll just say they are my favorite shots in the film of the mystics kind of lumbering across the landscape, and they're cut to two or three times. It just there's no real reason to cut to them other than just to kind of revel in the majesty of these giant puppet creatures lumbering through this landscape. And it's a really neat thing that I wouldn't want to sacrifice in order to have the story move more quickly. That said, the story does move pretty slow sometimes.
The lumbering mystics never bothered me. I mean, the fact that we cut back to them over and over is to remind us. I love those things. I mean, honestly, the mystics are my favorite thing in the film. Their lined faces, they're just so deeply and heavily lined. They look so worn. But you get these like extreme close-ups on them, and they still look real. They look so much more like actual creatures to me than Jen does. And I love their weird faces and their weird Brian Froud patterning. Like he's really into like Celtic knots and like complicated whorls, which you see on the Ursex at the end. There's a thing in the commentary where he's just complaining about how those things look nothing like what he wanted them to look
really?
Like. Yeah, he was promised a bunch of special effects. Like if you look at the front of them, there are all of these spiral patterns in their clothing, and the spiral patterns were supposed to be like alive and moving, and that was just a special effect that they never did. And he's still bitterly disappointed about it.
Circling back to the, you know, digging into this mythology that may not have been that well thought out to begin with, but you just reminded me of it, which is the clothing on the Skeksis. I felt like there was more there that wasn't addressed. I mean, the Skeksis, you know, their bodies are the way they are and they're clothed the way they are in order to disguise the operator inside of them. But there's that scene when the Chamberlain is banished where they strip him of his clothes. And I did read something about how the Skeksis are all kind of supposed to represent different vices and their clothings are meant to represent that. And I think that could have been something really cool in a neat story solution to a design problem, but it's just not really addressed in any satisfying way.
As I said, I was just really fascinated by this world, and I read the novelization over and over, and the novelization has more detail about some of the background stuff. I don't know how you would get that into the movie without slowing it down. Yes, they were originally designed around the seven deadly sins, and then they ended up with more of them. And I think in the mythology, there were originally 16 of them, but like over time, some of them degraded and some pairs were lost. So by the time you have 1,000 years later, you have the movie, there are only 9 of them, but each one of them has a purpose. And that's why they all look different. And that's why one of them manages the slaves and one of them manages the Garthim and one of them manages the science lab and the Chamberlain just hangs around the Emperor and makes weird whimpering noises. Like they each have a duty. And then the weird thing is the mystics
also each have kind of a corresponding like nature version of that.
Yeah.
So like the ritual master, which is the one that keeps waving the knife around and saying, we've got to kill her. That's the, that's our law. Like there's a corresponding mystic ritual master who's the one like doing the sand mandala at the beginning. There's always a like a harsh patterned evil version of this concept and then like a soft nature version of this concept, and that's something that just doesn't come across
right.
at all.
Yeah, I think it just kind of speaks to the greater theme of this movie, and I think it comes up in how often we are invoking Brian Froud's name as opposed to the writer of the film, who is David O'Dell, with obviously a story by Jim Henson. It's a concept movie, like a concept album. Like it's a broad idea and very kind of fixated on the minutiae that represent that idea, but it doesn't necessarily tell a detailed narrative.
That's a really cool comparison that I hadn't thought of. And I think you're right. And I also think that it kind of explains a lot tonally about where the film is, because it does kind of have the feel of one of those big 70s prog rock concept albums that's kind of telling a fantasy story. Sort of,
right?
You know, that's more about the concept and execution than necessarily that story.
You can't map out the story,
all the details of it. Well, I mean, Tasha, you can answer this better than anyone, I think, here at least. But this is really a huge departure from what Henson had been doing before. I mean, I know he'd taken stabs at this kind of story elsewhere, if I'm not mistaken. But I mean, this is someone who is used to dealing in short sketches and characters that, you know, are there for 5 minutes max, I guess, versus this sprawling story across a single world. I mean, do you feel like maybe there's sort of some growing pains that we're seeing on the screen, or do you feel like this is a complete vision that he saw through for as he wanted it to be?
No, I think you're exactly right when you say it's growing pains. Mm. I mean, he started this film with Brian Froud. Like he went to Brian Froud and kind of laid out the vague concept of what he wanted and signed a contract with him. And then he went away and made the Muppet Movie and The Great Muppet Caper. All of the concept work for Fraggle Rock happened before the film. The show itself came out after, but there was just so much work done in here. He had his hands in a lot of projects. And what was going on behind the scenes at the time was the Muppet Show had become a huge, huge hit. And basically, he started out in advertising, and he spent a decade trying to break into being able to do fiction. And it was a constant struggle for funding. It was a constant struggle to find backers. And when the Muppet Show finally hit, suddenly Big Bird was on the cover of Time magazine and Jim Henson was a superstar. I mean, he was making money with his advertising and he was getting attention for like the Muppets on the Ed Sullivan Show and the TV specials that he was doing that were spinoffs of those. He had popularity. He didn't have cachet. Hmm. And Dark Crystal came directly out of the fact that he made the Muppet Show and all of a sudden he was famous. He had a lot of money and he had people coming to him and saying, what next? What do you have next? What can we do that's different? And he was like, I've got stuff that I want to do that's different. I want to do these bigger, more expansive, more ambitious things. And I feel like Dark Crystal was partially a result of trying to do too many things at once and partially a result of having this gigantic ambition and trying to kind of realize it around all of the other projects that were going on at the time.
There's also, apart from a couple of moments and the little yippie not dog, whatever we're going to call that, Fizgig, it's almost consciously not funny. There aren't gags, there aren't jokes, and the characters, as endearing as they aren't really comic characters.
Of course not. You're a boy is kind of a joke.
Yeah.
That's probably the one joke, right?
Yeah. I just remember that as like hitting like a ton of bricks as a punchline in the theater. And maybe it's because the film was just so solemn for most of it. I mean, as you say, it's pretty grim stuff for kids.
Grimmer than I remember it, and grimmer than really most kids. I can't think of a grimmer, flat-out kids movie, insofar as this even is a kids movie. And in some ways, it's a high fantasy movie that just happens to have puppets in it. I wonder if he had pressed forward in this direction, the future such films might have had more of a balance, because it's not like Jim Henson doesn't do humor well. I mean, Henson is probably what he does best with puppets. I wonder if a little bit more of that kind of lightness and airiness might have found its way into a future such film.
Well, that's what we got with Labyrinth. I mean,
sure. I was wondering when Labyrinth, I actually have Labyrinth pulled up on my screen because I knew we were going to get there.
I haven't seen for as much the, you know, as for as many like 80s genre films as I've seen. And as much as I love David Bowie, I've never seen that movie.
Man, it's almost like you weren't a teenage girl in the
1980s. I always think of your line about how it kickstarted puberty
for a lot of women. I'm not sure I was there personally, but that is the kind of thing when you get a bunch of women of the right age and some alcohol together, that movie comes up, and it comes up in that context a lot. And it is just very funny to me. But from everything I've read, Labyrinth was the direct result of Henson saying, here's what worked and what didn't work on Dark Crystal. Here's what we need to improve. And with Labyrinth, they sat down and they worked out the story first. They worked out the themes first. They worked out what they wanted to say. And then they developed the world and the puppets and they put people into it.
Yeah, it's not puppets only.
No, it's got people that are specifically supposed to be relatable. You know, you're focused on their faces. It's got a human protagonist and a human antagonist, and then the puppets just kind of fill in the world around it. I don't know whether I would tell you to see it or not. I also saw that film at pretty much the exact right age. I mean, I was the age of the protagonist when I saw it.
I saw it in college for the first time and loved it. So I think you could.
I'll get around to it.
I don't think you have to worry about it jumpstarting your puberty, though.
Yeah.
That you might have to worry about it jumpstarting your daughter's puberty. Yeah. But seriously, if she likes fantasy stories at all, somewhere in the 13 to 16 age range is the time to see that movie.
Sure.
So we're coming across as very down on Dark Crystal.
We're
which,
not.
aren't we? I mean.
No, absolutely not.
Okay. So tell me what you're not down on. What do you find memorable about this film? What do you like about this film?
I like the tone of it a lot. I mean, it can be a little pokey and as we said, humorless, but you know, I basically enjoy the world of these films and the creatures. I find, especially the Skeksis and the Mystics, really impressive creatures. And in some ways, a lot more animated and understandable than Gelfland's. I like the Chamberlain's whole arc of being, you know, ambitious and then being humiliated and then being, you know, sneakily trying to ingratiate himself to the Gelfland's. That's a fairly complex character. And that's one of my favorite Frank Oz vocal performances too. That weird whiny. I won't even attempt to do it, but I like that a lot. And there's just moments in this film like I said before, but you know, I was being shown something I had not seen anywhere else before. Like the Landstriders, those like those giant four-legged sloth-like creatures. That's just a beautiful thing to watch. The Gelflings ride through this really elaborate landscape on those. I mean, that's you show me that, and you've already won me over for much of the film.
Have you ever seen the behind the scenes, like either the making of doc or just like the any of the behind the scenes TV stuff that shows you what's inside those suits?
No, but I know what's inside those suits.
Isn't that amazing?
It's interesting because when I watched this movie with some friends of mine, everyone kind of picked out the Landstriders is not that impressive because
no, I love the Landstriders.
Because it was, you could clearly see the people in it if you are familiar with the rig that they are using, which this film may have originated, I don't know, but it's something that has been probably most notably in The Lion King on Broadway. It's used a lot, this kind of quadruped human puppet rig, and it's been used in a lot of kind of big live productions. And having seen that once, you can't really unsee it when you see the Landstriders.
It's worth seeking out the behind the scenes stuff just to see people without the costumes on doing that. Mm. Like their legs are on stilts, but then they're leaning forward almost horizontal to the ground. And then their hands are also on stilts and they're just walking around like that. And it's terrifying. It looks like they're going to fall and die.
I mean, it's incredibly impressive from a performance perspective.
According to Froud's commentary, he's the one who came up with it.
I was wondering if this is where it originated.
Yeah, somebody on staff. Well, there's always a parallel evolution. They may have been the first to do it, but other people may have created it, or other people may have created it earlier or in different ways in other places. But yeah, one of the puppeteers came onto the set and was talking about his stilts, and Froud wanted him to bring them in and stilt around so he could see it. And then he was like, could you lean forward? And the guy's like, yeah, but that's incredibly dangerous. And he said, well, could you lean forward if you had hand stilts? And then they presented that to Henson and were like, can we build a puppet around this? And Henson was incredibly excited. I feel like that's one of the genesises of my fascination with Henson behind the scenes is seeing a TV special where they talked about that and they showed behind the scenes footage of that. And it focused entirely on Henson's fascination with finding new ways to make puppets move. Those things are so strange and wonderful to watch, I think. What else? What connects with you about the film?
I think we've talked enough about how impressive the Skeksis and the Mystics are. So I did want to kind of draw attention to some of the smaller puppets and how they kind of inhabit this landscape. I'm thinking specifically of the little fuzzball rodent-like things, which I guess are called crawlies. The first couple times I saw them like kind of flit through the background, I thought it was maybe a mistake or something. And then I realized like, oh, they're just like mice or something. And then the scene during the climax where Kira calls on all the animals that apparently the Skeksis have imprisoned to kind of rise up and fight for her. There's just a really great variety of different types of puppets. And I think just seeing all those different types and sizes of puppets just drives home the thought that was put into this world, right down to like the little rodents skittering across the floor. You know, when we were talking just a minute ago about like whether we were being hard on this film or not, like the word I keep coming back to is impressive. It's a very impressive thing to watch because you are just kind of focusing on all the effort that went into it. And that is fun to watch in its own way, but it's not necessarily affecting the way that film can be affecting. I think a small touch like all these little crawlies or, you know, appreciating all the different types of puppets, it kind of plays into that impressive feeling. You're impressed by all the thought that went into this, even if you're like not really touched by it.
I think that's really the best way to put it is, frankly, I had the same problem with Kubo, and we'll get to that, but there's so much visible effort on the screen. There's so much visible thought and craft and attention to detail on the screen. It's a little disappointing when you don't feel the same kind of like emotional connection that you know you're expected to have.
You don't feel affection for it. Like you feel the maker's affection for their world, but it doesn't translate onto you as a viewer.
I feel affection for the makers.
Yeah.
Like for making that thing.
Right.
But I don't necessarily.
Good job, people who made this.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I feel a really personal connection to Jim Henson that I do not always feel to every one of his works. I admire the breadth of what he does, the ambition of what he does, and just like the goodness, like the kindness behind what he does. And that doesn't always necessarily translate into loving, you know, the actual product. You know what I do love here, though, is Billy Whitelaw's voice as Agra. That's just something I've always connected with. She's such a strange figure in this film.
Yeah.
I mean, in some ways, she's kind of your standard issue Oracle, Sybil character. You know, you come along into the hero's journey, deliver some information, be weird and wise and obscure all at the same time. But she's also got, like, visible nipples and like a really fat ass and like an incredibly gross eyeball gripped in an incredibly gross hand with like filthy fingernails and peeling skin. I mean, somebody put a lot of effort into making her kind of disgusting. And I love that vocal characterization so much.
You know what I think would have improved this movie? Cameos from Steve Martin, Edgar Bergen. Maybe Charles Grodin.
Should they have just popped up every time somebody said, I don't know what to do with this crystal shard. What if I throw the crystal and miss? Somebody should have popped up and said, myth? Yes?
Hey, is that Twiggy?
Oh, dear. Okay, well, we're definitely winding down here a little bit on Dark Crystal. But there's still more to talk about. We'll be right back to talk about some of the other films that readers suggested we should pair with Kubo for this episode and to talk a little bit about the options that we had to reject because this podcast cannot be a 25-hour podcast. First, word from our sponsor. We wound up pairing Kubo with Dark Crystal because they had so much in common behind the scenes, including directors who started out in advertising and created their own studios to do creative work, and then insisted on staying as hands-on as possible with their projects instead of taking backseat management positions. But we also had a lot of other suggestions from readers as well, and many of them would also have made great pairings. Are there any that particularly stand out for you guys?
Yeah, I mean, one maybe I should have pushed for, maybe we'll do it some other time, is Kwaidan, which is this Japanese film from 1965 by Masaki Kobayashi. And it is an anthology film of four different, I want to say horror stories, but more like spooky folk tales. And it'd be interesting for a couple of ways, because it's all of them take place in very stylized worlds, not unlike Kubo. And there's sort of an East meets West thing going on too, where they're adapted from stories collected by a man known, among other names, as Lafcadio Hearn, who was sort of this Greek kid who came to America, became a journalist, went to Japan, and published Japanese folktales. But I think there was some kind of a question as how much personal embellishment is in it. Anyway, the movie's gorgeous. The movie is just sort of this haunting, each section better than the last in some ways. So I feel like I'm already doing my next picture show recommendation here, but Quiet Eye would have been great.
Wasn't that Sam Adams' suggestion?
Was it Sam's? Yeah, it was Sam's. Yeah,
that alone. Sam Adams. Like that alone made me want to do it. I've never seen Quite On.
Oh, my recommendation isn't good enough for you, but Sam Adams recommends it.
I believe that Sam Adams recommended this film that What's His Face across from me was talking about. Genevieve, anything particularly stand out for you?
Well, several people made the suggestion, which we also discussed before throwing this question to Twitter and Facebook, looking at Coraline because of the obvious Laika connection there. And I think we're all fans of Coraline, and I think we all would have liked discussing that movie. But I guess for me, kind of one of the main sticking points of doing that movie is that it's so informed by Neil Gaiman's sensibility, I think. And just in terms of Kubo being such a pure Laika movie, it felt like it would be a weird jumping off point as a comparison. But there's definitely a lot going on in Coraline that maybe we'll be able to talk about on a future show for some reason. But
yeah, another problem with doing Coraline is just, I mean, that's a Henry Selick directed movie.
Right.
And there's a lot of kind of undercurrent that you can pick up about how Selick and Laika got along.
Brilliantly.
Not so brilliantly. Well, I mean, he left the studio after that, and there was apparently a lot of negative feedback. It's so hard to tell in a situation like this. Is this their negative feedback because there is in any workplace, and anytime you have somebody with the high standards forcing people to live up to them, you're going to have some people who are angry and don't like that? Or was he a cruel taskmaster who didn't care about the people under him and worked them to the bone in pursuit of like tiny details that didn't necessarily make a difference to other people? Mm. Like you can find kind of both of those reactions online. And we don't know what the truth is.
Maybe we should have had that discussion the week that Scott wasn't here, because it's all extra textual.
Oh, it's all extra textual. So I mean, this entire conversation with Dark Crystal Kubo is kind of heavily extra textual. Yeah. So, yeah, Scott. But that, I mean, I think it would have been interesting just to see kind of how Laika's developed over the past 10 years. For me, one of the reasons to hold back on Coraline is that those movies to me are just too close together visually, aesthetically, and in time. Mm. You know, that's a fairly short time period for a studio that can only come out with a film every 2.5 years or so.
Yeah, we did Pixar, early Pixar versus late Pixar. It felt, you know, the big leap, and the films were different enough. This didn't feel quite right.
Yeah, and I mean, that was only 15 years instead of 10, but the technology changed so much. Mm-hmm. And it hasn't made as much of a difference for Laika. We also got a suggestion that we do James and the Giant Peach for the stop motion, which is a really interesting thought.
I think someone suggested Nightmare Before Christmas. Basically, any stop motion animated film was I think suggested at some point.
We talked about doing Jan Svankmajer's Alice.
Yeah, give everyone nightmares talking about that one. Someone suggested Jason the Argonauts, the Ray Harryhausen stop motion adventure, which or any of them would have been good. I'm hugely fond of those movies, and that would have been a lot of fun.
Here's one that we got from Facebook that I really like the argument for. Mulan might be interesting, since they're both examples of Western animation studios adapting concept from Eastern stories. They also both prominently feature swordplay and parental relationships. Also, while both are examples of animation, they're completely different types of animation, which would let you comment about the unique effects of each approach. And I mean, that's what we like to see, is people not just throwing out titles, but like making coherent arguments for them. And that was a really good one. On the other hand, Mulan, like, it's got some really strong moments, and then in some ways it's semi-forgettable Disney.
Yeah, Mulan was actually one of the very first things that came to my mind, but I don't think I even bothered suggesting it, because I was like, I don't think anyone likes Mulan all that much. But I actually do like Mulan quite a bit, but I think there are a lot of problems in that movie that I didn't necessarily want to get into on this podcast. Mm.
But it's got songs by the guy who did Break My Stride.
And one of the songs is I'll Make a Man Out of You, mm-hmm. which is one of my favorite Latter-day Disney songs.
Yeah, we can have a sing-along after this because it's one of my favorites too.
I've only seen that one once a long time ago. I should watch it again.
There are some other interesting suggestions for films that have to do specifically with the power of storytelling, like Terry Gilliam's Baron Munchausen, The Fall, which is a big favorite film of mine.
We're going to do The Fall at some point just because this is a podcast with Tasha Robinson.
Tasha made us sign a contract before starting this podcast that we would eventually talk about The Fall.
I don't know what we're going to pair it with. Maybe the next time that Tarsem makes a really good movie, so you won't have to worry about that contract coming up. Millennium Actress is also an anime film that's very specifically about the power of self-mythologizing and storytelling. And it's a Japanese movie. It's got a heavy Japanese influence, obviously. So, like, all of those, I think, are really interesting conceptual things.
We love the suggestions. Those are great.
Yeah, thanks. And thanks to everybody who participated.
We ignored all of them. Oh, and Princess Bride.
Yeah, for sure.
I think those are all films we might do it.
I would have loved to do a conversation on Princess Bride, but I think the connection may have been just a little bit too tenuous mm-hmm. there, because it's like story within a story and fantasy.
In terms of tone, though, it would be the exact opposite direction from the Dark Crystal.
It would, yes. We'll talk about Princess Bride someday. Or just
really? I think that's inconceivable.
All right.
Anyway, so thanks to everybody who participated. We did really appreciate it. And we did, in fact, think about and talk about these discussions, despite what Keith just said. As always, we do appreciate when our listeners share their thoughts and their recommendations. To reach us, you can leave a short voicemail at 773-234-9730 or email us at comments@nextpictureshow.net. You can also, obviously, in this case, talk to us on Facebook at facebook.com/nextpictureshow or on Twitter at twitter.com/nextpicturepod. We may feature your response on a future episode or post it on Facebook for discussion. That's it for this episode of the Next Picture Show. In the second half, we'll set aside one kind of puppet and pick up another kind as we look into the craft of Kubo and the Two Strings and how 3D printers and molded resin compared with felt and glass eyes when you're telling an epic story. You'll also get to hear this.
I think I had to stretch to go full sucker punch with this one. There's not a lot to suggest that
to me. I was going to say Saint Elsewhere, but
I was thinking of that too.
Pick your reference.
Look for that later this week, or better yet, subscribe to the Next Picture Show on iTunes or your podcatcher of choice. Follow us at facebook.com/nextpictureshow. Follow us on Twitter at nextpicturepod, so you'll always know when a new episode drops. Until then, the good part of the story is coming up. So if you must blink, do it now.